Welcome back to Southern Ghost Stories. I'm your host, Alan Searcy. So I hope you enjoyed last week's episode about the old Galt House in Louisville, Kentucky. If you'd like to learn more about the old hotel, please check out our book, Southern Ghost Stories Louisville. Today, we're going to be talking about the old Central State Hospital in Nashville, Tennessee. After the original Tennessee Hospital for the Insane on 12th Avenue South was deemed unfit in 1848, the Tennessee State Legislature allocated funds to build a new facility on the Murfreesboro Turnpike, which is 6 miles south of downtown Nashville. So the new facility, it was a large fortress-like structure, and it was erected on the site there, South Nashville. The Tennessee Hospital for the Insane officially opened in 1851, but it was rebranded Central State Hospital for the Insane the following year. And even though the patients were now being treated in a state-of-the-art healthcare facility, by modern standards, the treatment was quite primitive. While isolation was standard and a genuinely accepted means of punishment for patients and inmates, in the mid to late 19th century, those in the asylum were put in straitjackets and thrown in a pitch-black basement for an extended amount of time. In some cases, bloodletting, electric shock, and lobotomies were performed on patients suffering from various conditions. On the night of March 13, 1891, a desperate inmate looking to escape started a fire in the west wing of Central State. Around 10:15 p.m., thick black smoke was spotted by a night watchman coming from that part of the asylum. As the entire hospital was evacuated, the fire department was called. Unfortunately, the fire chief couldn't be found, and the fire company refused to come to the scene without direct orders. Yet a few hours later, the chief arrived at the fire hall and ordered his men to the asylum. By the time the firefighters arrived at Central State with two horse-drawn engines, the west wing had collapsed, and the entire hospital was at risk of being burned to the ground. Central State staff, inmates, and volunteers formed a bucket brigade from a nearby pond and battled the blaze alongside the fire company. After several long hours, the fire was finally extinguished. Of the 125 patients at Central State that night, only 8 died in the fire. Each of them was stuck in the west wing after it collapsed. It was believed the trapped inmates died from smoke inhalation. One female inmate died after being evacuated. In the confusion, she fell into a pond, and she didn't know how to swim. By the time anyone saw her, she had drowned. So the mental hospital was rebuilt, and gradually life went back to normal. During the mid-20th century, Central State's population exploded, and the hospital grew from a few hundred to over 2,200 patients. While some of the patients were admitted voluntarily, many were sent there by the courts to receive treatment. With so many people coming into the facility, dozens of buildings like a superintendent's house and a hilltop rehab facility were added to the complex. Yet despite the influx of patients, Central State's budget stayed the same. Well, in 1964, Dr. John Wilson became the new superintendent of the hospital. One of his first tasks was to find a way to trim the fat and eliminate some of the 2,220 patients that Central State couldn't afford to care for. Shortly after an extensive review process, 84 inmates who had spent over a combined 2,000 years in the asylum were released. Two of the inmates set free were originally teenagers that were locked up for over 30 years. One of them had stolen an ear of corn as a kid. The other was sent to Central State for public intoxication. Some of the patients discharged were men in their 70s and 80s that had spent over 40 years in the facility. Ironically, one patient returned shortly after he was released. After spending 20 years at Central State, one man was hired immediately after he was released, and he worked there as an aide. While Dr. Wilson's plan to release patients did shake things up at the hospital, the local paper, The Tennessean, dropped an atomic bomb on the facility in January 1971 about the conditions and practices of Central State. An undercover reporter named Frank Sutherland sought to admit himself in December 1973. He met with an administrator and asked to get treatment. Though he confessed to the doctor he'd been suicidal, Sutherland received no psychiatric evaluation. Instead, the reporter was admitted for 31 days until he walked right past a guard and off the property the following January. In fact, Sutherland actually waved and said goodbye to the guard, who did nothing to stop him. In his series of articles about his time in the hospital, Sutherland railed against Central State, calling it a warehouse for the storage of people that wasn't unaccredited by the government. According to his investigative reporting and undercover work, he discovered that 8 of the 14 doctors were from out of the country and didn't have medical licenses. Also, technicians, known as aides, were only required to have an 8th grade education to work there at Central State. The aides were often more of a hindrance than a help to patients in some cases, and fights between the patients and the aides were commonplace. Those on the inside knew that if they wanted marijuana or alcohol, the orderlies could obtain it for them. In addition to procuring drugs, aides were often known to steal foods from patients. One patient had voluntarily checked himself out told Sutherland, "The aides are sicker than the patients." Personal hygiene was all but non-existent there at the hospital, as the undercover reporter got lice in athlete's foot during his stay. In order to shave, he had to share razor blades with fellow patients in bathrooms that were covered in urine, feces, and vomit. And although cats were kept on the property as a deterrent to mice, the facility was infested with mice and roaches. And some of them were actually captured and kept by the patients there as pets. So in the month Sutherland was committed to the asylum, he lost 10 pounds. The rapid weight loss was due in large part to a diet of eggs, toast, and rice for breakfast, and lukewarm spaghetti noodles, minus spaghetti sauce. When the Tennessean began airing the series of articles in January 1974, Central State Superintendent, he didn't dispute the expose. He got on the defensive and blamed the infractions on low pay, understaffing, and lack of equipment. After the atrocities of Central State were brought to light, patients were moved out of its old, outdated buildings that didn't have electricity. To help solve issues with overcrowding, doctors started referring patients to community centers. In addition to all the tragedy that took place at Central State, one of the stories that sticks out to me is a social worker named Rose, who worked in the hospital in the 1960s. My grandmother worked at the hospital for a while in the 60s, and she was really fond of Rose when she first started. Rose was a very respectable, prim and proper lady who took a lot of pride in her appearance and wore nice clothing. So she worked there with my grandmother, but after a while, my grandmother noticed that she had the smell of alcohol on her. And things got so bad, eventually she had to be committed there in the hospital. According to my grandmother, it didn't really affect her seeing the patients, but when people like her co-workers started getting committed, it really started to bother her. She worked there for 11 years. They asked her to come back when she quit, and she told them no. After 147 years in operation, the old Central State shut down in 1995 after some inmates started a fire and a riot in the facility. The remaining patients were relocated to a new mental health facility in nearby Donelson. On the south end of the old hospital campus is a burying ground that was originally a potter's field for patients that died there in the hospital. After folks began dying in the asylum, officials notified the next of kin. But in most cases, the relatives couldn't pay to have their remains sent back home. The state provided a simple wooden coffin, and a patient was buried there in the cemetery. Even though each individual received a complimentary casket, markers and tombstones were only provided if a family member chose to buy one. Sadly, many of those buried in the Potter's Field remain a mystery due to the lack of headstones and accurate records. The 1.4-acre burial ground contains 300 documented graves. Nevertheless, the old Potter's Field is believed to contain over 1,600 graves. All records were lost in 1974 when a tornado struck the hospital archives building. Once the hospital closed, the cemetery was forgotten about, and the grass and weeds began to overtake the remaining markers. Fortunately, state officials stepped in and placed the remaining headstones against a tree there in the old potter's field. Given the awful history of Central State, it's not a surprise to hear that many thought the asylum was haunted. When the facility was in operation, some people who worked there always talked about feeling uneasy and hearing the strange sounds of disembodied voices and doors closing in empty rooms. Today, the property is home to a warehouse and an insurance company. But those grounds and the buildings that are there now, they say they're haunted too. Those who work overnight have been known to hear voices and sometimes see shadows darting around the building. One longtime associate told me that she couldn't believe her eyes one night when she heard someone walk by, and when she turned around, she saw an orderly dressed in white slowly fade away. Security personnel who work around the clock they're the most inclined to hear or see strange things. So the motion detector there in the building, it often goes off just at random times. And the guards think it's just a playful phantom, just messing with them, just to get them to go see what's wrong. So, thanks for tuning in this week, and be sure to subscribe and review the show. Also, check out the Southern Ghost Stories Facebook page, and also Instagram account. And be sure to check out the Southern Ghost Stories YouTube page. Lots of cool videos over there. We also archive the shows there on YouTube. And lastly, check out the Southern Ghost Stories books on Amazon and BarnesandNoble.com. And if you go in the Barnes & Noble stores, if you don't find them, ask your manager. They can order them for you. Next week, check back, because I'll be talking about the Stones River Battlefield in Murfreesboro, Tennessee. What's orange and sounds like a parrot? Huh? What's orange and sounds like a parrot? Mama? Mama? What's orange and sounds like a parrot? A carrot.
That's orange and sounds like...